Hello and welcome to the Final Draft Books and Writing on 2SER. I'm Genevieve McGregor. About a month ago, I had a lovely opportunity to record the winner and highly commended poets of the Blake Poetry Prize. There's something quite magic about poetry read aloud, but there's something particularly wonderful about a poet reading their own work, phrases and words well considered by pen and by tongue. And tonight we get to hear them over the airways. We will start with Sydney-based poet Fiona Wright's The Fox Man, which was highly commended by the judges.
The Fox Man. Lavernius lies in the peat swamp, mud-marrowed bones and mud-licked marbled flesh, or half of him. There's a leg and a haunch gone, but you still can see where the tight garrote has bedded in his neck and the jugular's been cut for the rush of blood to fill the cup running over after they struck the back and crown of his poor head with a blunted axe. Then they twisted the wire. They needed a knee in his back to get a purchase on it, and thus they broke his ribs. Then they bled him. His blood was the point. That was the gift. Then they roped him in a chariot, or was it a cart? Was the blank-eyed goddess propped at his side? And they drove him through the god-stuffed black enchanted night to the pool by the swamp, and they slid him in. Perhaps there was observance to the god who likes his darlings drowned, or perhaps by then they were tired, and they smelt the Romans on the wind, and they wanted the blood glut over. So they let him go, and the mud-dark waters closed over him. And you think, is there anything, oh, anything in this world or the unlikely vacuum of the next for which you'd swap three axe blows to the head, a wire garrote, a knife in the throat, your body's hog-drained blood and the cold stink of brown-black muddy water? Lavernicus lies in the peat swamp. Lavernicus dances with the golden gods. They stroke his body, finger the fox strap on his arm, cradle the cracked and blackened head. Lavernius dances with the gods. They fling him up, bones, breast, scarred throat, skin all lightened of the burdened of its blood, the sad hiatus of his ribs. Lavernius lies with the gods. The wild-eyed goddess shifts her golden body, nuzzles his torn, peach-shredded lips.
That was Fiona Wright's poem, The Fox Man. We'll be hearing more from her later with the latest instalment from The Rereaders. Now we'll be hearing from Todd Turner, who was also highly commended for his poem, Fieldwork. And it's interesting because you might actually hear some similar themes between Todd and Fiona's work.
This poem is called Fieldwork by Todd Turner. The hilltop backs onto a concrete hedge. Urban towers that are sheltered by a stand of trees, native gums, strewn figs, and a pair of hoop pines, older than the root-broken tar-gravel path below. As much an enclosure as an open field, this slope is home to the red-blue-winged swallow, the white moth, the lapwing, and the crow. Home to earth-digging corellas, the pestilent miner and its pesky herd. And one day, to a magpie who, bedraggled, lay face down on the path. I first thought it a crow until, angling it up with my boot, I saw her grey upper tail, her white rump, and ashy underwing. A gassy stench rose from under her, and field ants moved in and out of her beak. With two thickish twigs, I stretched her over to the foot of a pine, buried her with matted conifer brush, debris and leaves. I left her there to the hide beetles and the flesh-boring burying beetles who would come to grapple through seed cone, stick and leaf, mud, and at last, by way of orifice, would sheath her, nosh on her ripe tissue and fleshy muck, before leaving eggs in a crypt scraped under her remains. Larvae would move into beetledom, into the birth wing of the hutted carcass, and there draw on the phlegmy gush of blood and bone. Later, when I saw that the wind had threshed the burial to a thatch of knotted sticks, I eagerly peered into an opening, rummaged through empty afterwork to find clumped feathers and a wing partially intact. Digging further, I hit upon a skull, then another, the first, that of a petite bird, a swallow perhaps, its vertebrae like the cast mould of an unset jewel. The second was clearly that of the magpie. I stepped back and stood staring into the hollowed-out eyes, the gone brain, spiralling and turning it upside down, prying the underside with my eye, thumbing and spinning it into a circle, thinking and even speaking. I know what the cycle serves, but what is being served by the cycle? It's arguable, I know. Best to just walk and fall in love with the field, the beloved range of the ubiquitous grass.
That was Todd Turner with his poem Fieldwork. I got a chance to interview Todd after the reading about life as a goldsmith and a poet, and I started by asking him about the inspiration for his poem.
Well, this poem came out of my own experience where I discovered a bird, a dead bird, this magpie, just outside of my unit block, and it was dead, and I picked it up with some sticks that were nearby and buried it under a hoop pine where the fallen pines were in the conifer brush, and over the next day or two, and then a few days later, I stuck my head in and to see what was happening.
And have you always been interested in writing about mortality?
No. My family background really is from the Western Plains, or my family came from there. So metaphysics, whenever it enters my poetry, is usually earthbound. So this was a good opportunity to write a poem about mortality, being so centred and grounded close to me and my home.
And you said that you've been writing poetry for about 8 years. Can you tell us a bit about how you first became inspired to write?
Yes. Well, I had never, not at school anyhow, never read any poetry really. I was always interested in folk music through my family, and country music, and for the lyrics, of course. And one day I discovered a book by William Butler Yeats in a little cart outside of a bookshop, and when I picked it up and read it, I quickly latched on to poetry and began reading all kinds of poetry from all over the world.
And you mentioned you're a goldsmith, so how does poetry and goldsmithing work together?
I think there's similar traits, if you could put it that way. Goldsmithing requires a lot of isolated time, and it's quite a grueling craft. And I think that for me, poetry, or the writing of poetry, requires the same sort of discipline. So perhaps the two go in hand in some way for me.
And that was poet Todd Turner. Finally, the winner of the 2011 Blake Poetry Prize is Robert Adamson. And this is his poem.
The Divine Dark. Robert Adamson. My worthiness is all my doubt. Emily Dickinson. A poem without birds. This morning the fern trees woke and opened out as sunlight dispersed a thick mist. This morning, in a memory incised with old phrases, mouthing words, then uttering a sentence with your unfinished breath. Banana trees rustle. A first breeze arrives, bringing the perfumes of the ebb. Watermarks down on the mudflats begin to evaporate. Morning turns its back on the sun, then gradually the night arrives. In the skylight, stars appear through the smoke screen from a burn-off. Brilliant pinholes. Stars are clustered trees hung in the night sky. Whose body? Whose eyes? Look up into the heavens. The problem of suffering expands forever. Dust and light again. Maybe time, if it exists. On the table, a cicada flecked with flour, opening its dry cellophane wings. The cat flies across polished space, illuminated by the kitchen's energy light-saving bulb, a Philips genie. Life like a dirty wind blowing straight through a snowy head, cat's eyes, tint of fur, rustling wings. Praise life with broken words. A preliminary sketch. What I see not, I better see. Emily Dickinson. An old shack by the river, deserted for years now, haunted by mesh nets and anchor rope. Wild apple trees grow out the back. A charcoal sketch of this scene unfurls before me on a sheet of mist. I push aside tough vines of morning glory and then walk on into the drawing. It's difficult to move in this landscape, and I have forgotten the names of most flora and fauna. Cross-hatched charcoal enfolds me. I become a part of the subject matter, my shape drawn carefully, sharp and figurative. However, precision no longer interests me. My attention is focused by smudges, the forms grown vague. Just 50 years ago, a country of sandstone and gums. A second ago, ferns and hardship. The heavy tidal swings roll corks and drown fish, caught by their gills in the smothering mesh. In the distance, bushfire writes its killer lines. Orange loops, burning serifs, spill over the sandstone escarpments. I fished these tides when I was young and abstract. What rubbed off? What idea sunk home? I rejected the lessons and feared my mother's God, the Christ I couldn't believe in. The friends in those days, the ones I loved, are now drawn beside me in the margins. The kirk we attended appears, the place where the minister refused to tell me exactly what a soul might be, although mine, come judgment day, would be flung into hell, along with the others who weren't chosen. The Presbyterian soul is not mysterious. Rather, it's something we were lumped with. Now I rise from the sketch, my face smeared with ink from years of sinning. Back on the river, my boat ploughs through fog. I'm looking hard. What form, shape, or song might represent a soul? What words, paint or mud, resemble such an intangible glow? A stain of mist hangs above a black butt, brushed by the wings of a grey-headed flying fox.
So can you tell me a bit about where that poem came from?
Well, I've been writing it for about a year, and I was reading books like St. Augustine's Confessions, and I have a friend, Kevin Hart, who is a poet, and he studies religions, and I was talking to him about, we had an interview in Heat magazine about the possibility of God, and I said I didn't believe in God, and Kevin said, well, the way you write, it's your doubt is so intense it's the same as belief. And you can believe through a negative theology as much as you can by just faith. And I started thinking about all that, and I started reading a lot about what a soul was and wondering what a soul was and if animals had souls. And so this is really the poem that I wrote that inquires about all those things.
Mm. And you've quoted Emily Dickinson twice there.
Yeah, well she writes about this all the time. Yeah. Yeah, constantly writes about it. And her and William Blake are the two poets that most engage in that subject. Well, especially where William Blake says, to see the world in a grain of sand and heaven in a wildflower, to hold eternity in the palm of your hand. You know, and the two quotes that I have here, I was fascinated by that. My worthiness is all my doubt. So she sees the fact that she doubts everything as a positive.
Mm.
And what I see not, I better see. And that's like William Blake, where he says, the invisible worm that flies through the night in the howling storm has found out thy bed of scarlet joy. This invisible world and doubt are the two subjects of both those poets. And so by reading through all their... I read both Emily Dickinson and Blake over the last year all the time. And after reading their works and trying to write a poem about the similar subjects is really intimidating because they do it so well. So I just tried to base this on my experiences in my life, but going back to when I was a kid, my grandmother was Scottish and we were sent to a kirk in Neutral Bay, which was really fierce Presbyterian kind of, which put me off.
I can understand that.
But I had a great respect for it, even though it was, I was this fearful kind of God, punishing sort of God. Tying it all together in this poem, yeah. Mm.
Todd was mentioning in when we were talking that he thinks that at the moment there's a bit of a golden age of Australian poetry. Do you think that's true?
I do. I've just, in the last 2 years, I edited the best Australian poems for Black Ink. And I would have read 2,000 or 3,000 poems in each year to choose the 80 poems that were in that anthology. And I just had so many good poems to choose from, and it was really cruel to have to leave out maybe up to 50 poems in both those anthologies that were good enough to be in them, but boy, there just wasn't enough space.
Mm.
Usually it's the other way around. I used to edit a poetry magazine, new poetry for years and years, and usually we couldn't get enough to fill an issue with really good work. But now it seems to be blossoming. Yeah, it definitely is, yeah. Mm. And there's lots of new poets that are really good,
mm.
Really very, very good.
That was Robert Adamson, winner of the 2011 Blake Poetry Prize, speaking about the current golden age of Australian poetry. I hope we're right. Before that, we heard two of the Blake Prize highly commended poets, Fiona Wright and Todd Turner. To read more, go to www.blakeprize.com.au, and we'll also provide links on our website. Up next, the rereaders are back right after this.
Miles.
That was Beirut with the song East Harlem. And you're listening to The Final Draft on 2SER with me, Genevieve McGregor. Literary magazines are having to find new ways to engage readers online, providing new and different content to their print output. This week, the rereaders look at a new digital venture by the Melbourne-based literary journal Meanjing, in which books do battle with other books. This is the rereaders.
Hi, and welcome to the rereaders for Final Draft. I'm Sam Twyford-Moore. Joining me are Rebecca Giggs.
Hi, Sam.
Hi, Rebecca. And Fiona Wright.
Hello, Sam.
Hi, Fiona. This week, we're talking about the Meanjin Tournament of Books. Meanjin, Australia's second oldest literary journal, has recently relaunched its website with the announcement that they will make all of the content in the print edition available online. In addition, they have launched the Meanjin Tournament of Books. And for the inaugural version, they have pitted novels by Australian women against each other. In the first bout, journalist Anna Crean decided that Joan London's Gilgamesh beat out Michelle de Cresta's The Lost Dog. This will all keep going until a winner is crowned. Our own Rebecca Giggs decided round two, which featured Elizabeth Jolly's Mr. Scobie's Riddle versus Helen Garner's The Children's Bark. Rebecca, how did you come to pick the heavyweight of women's Oz Lit?
Oh, do you know, I didn't actually pick it. It was delegated to me.
Oh, no, I meant how did you pick the winner? Because you decided
the winner. Oh, I see. Ah, well, that was a long and detailed process with many criteria. I originally thought that I was going to really empathise with Elizabeth Jolly because being a West Australian writer and that's where I'm from and I hadn't come across her work before. So for me it was almost this battle between, you know, home locale and new locale. And I thought Jolly's writing in my mind would be very staid and very prosaic but she's nothing
amazing.
Like that at all. She's very, you know, very experimental. The voices are hilarious. Really, really dynamic and lively book, which contains its own operating instructions. At any length, I had to choose the Garner because the Garner, I think I said at the end of the review, I ruin the books that I love. I turn down the corners of the pages, I'm underlining, and by the time I finished, I just held up both books. And although I very much enjoyed the Jolly, the Garner was in a state of ruin. So
to explain the system, they pick two books, pair them together, versus each other, and then they choose a female writer, essentially, like someone in the writing community, to comment on the two, choose a winner, and then it goes on to the next round, and we'll meet the winner of the previous round. There's also a commentary beneath it. Fiona, what did you think?
I don't like the commentary.
Really?
It's quite snide, isn't it?
It's. I find it a little bit snide and a little bit silly. I mean, there's nothing wrong with silliness. I'm a big fan of silliness for its own sake, but it seems to pick apart the interesting turns of phrase or the metaphors or the bits that make the criticism interesting and lively and personal to that particular reviewer's voice, and then just take the piss out.
It's kind of superfluous in a sense because you've already got the, you know, it's a piece of commentary, the review of the two books itself. It's Ben Pobjee and Jess Maguire, who are two comedians based in Melbourne, and they're providing a small commentary track beneath each. I was worried when I read the one that was beneath yours, Rebecca, because it did exactly what Fiona said, where it's picking apart the reviewer's writing. I mean, to quote from Jess Maguire, she said, "I think I may begin using the term architecturally shambolic," which was your term, Rebecca, "in my day-to-day life as a euphemism for totally off my chops." So she was kind of attacking your mode of writing.
I actually have no idea what it means to be totally off my chops. Yeah, well, you know, I'm pretty thick-skinned. That wasn't an issue.
No, and I don't think they're personal attacks on anybody. No. I just think they're superfluous.
I actually don't like the way it's structured as a like a reading experience online. I think that you know, not to get into an in-depth conversation about this, but I think not only the Tournament of Books, but the way the site is set up is very counterintuitive and not, you know.
Well, this is their new relaunch and they're stating their online presence as a big exclamation mark statement by putting all the content up for free.
And by running new projects.
Yeah,
like
and running
books.
New, which can only exist in an online space. This isn't something that you could bring out with each Meanjin. It'd take too long.
And they're not necessarily essays or critiques. There's kind of that, they're in that borderline between written work and performance or something that could happen live and something that can only happen on print. It's this strange in-between space that they're using, and I think in that sense it's a really interesting project. Mm.
And it's exposing these books to a wider audience, yeah, which is a good thing. And there's some funny, you know, there's some good writing coming. Yours is brilliant, Rebecca, of course.
Thanks,
Dan. But I loved Caro Cooper on Miles Franklin's My Beautiful Career. It's Chiclet Among the Gums, you know.
That was great.
And that's taken off as a little statement in itself. I guess to finish up, who do you think is going to win?
It was difficult. One of the things I do like is the website has a little game plan that you can download, like they have at tennis tournaments, and see who's being pitted against each other. And I would really like to see
Carpentaria.
Yes, I'd really like to see Carpentaria win. I'd forgotten about that entirely. But
that's from your
publisher. The good money is on Alexis, right?
The good money.
There's a betting ring going. Well, at least, you know, Tina, I was approached by bookies.
Well, exactly. I mean, this is...
But I'm inside.
This is the good thing. I think we should put money down. I want Garner to win because I just love her and we're all on a kick. But I think Christina Stead may take it with The Man Who Loved Children. I feel like that's got a weighty worthiness to it.
A match that I would really like to see is Christina Stead versus Alexis Wright.
Mm.
Well, that could be the grand final.
That would be awesome.
I think I'd put my money on that being the grand final. Thanks, Rebecca.
Thank you, Sam.
Thank you, Fiona.
Thank you, Sam.
You've been listening to The Rereaders for Final Draft. You can find us at www.thereereaders.com.
That was Sam Tyford-Moore, Rebecca Giggs and Fiona Wright, and the producer of The Rereaders is Jessica Minchell. And that's all we have time for tonight. Tune in next week for Dystopias, Utopias and a little bit of Martin Hewitson. Speak to you next week.